This is Pauline Frederick. I'm speaking to you from the studio at United Nations headquarters in New York. With me today are people from your hometown and mine. In a moment, we will begin an exciting exploration into a program we have called You and Article 71.
The National Broadcasting Company and United Nations Radio present You and Article 71, a special feature for UN Day today. Here now is Pauline Frederick.
Before I say another word, I want you to hear something, or rather, some people.
Yes, I got your seat.
Here, look at the sticky. Panic, can you be sticky here?
The voices you hear are those of the thousands of visitors who throng to the UN headquarters, people from your hometown and mine, voices of delegates, of secretariat members, all blended together as they work and as they celebrate today the 10th anniversary of the United Nations. 10 years ago, the Charter of the United Nations was ratified. And from that day, an action program has been developed that involves the destiny of millions of the world's citizens everywhere, not only in the political field, but also in the areas of economics, education, health, food, the basic things of life for us all. Actually, the ultimate objective of all of UN's massive intergovernmental machinery is people. More specifically, individuals. Something happened in San Francisco in 1945 that made history for you and for me. We were included in the Charter of the United Nations. You know that that charter reads, "We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind." Note, it says, "We, the peoples," not "we, the governments." Going back to the old League of Nations days, we know that many organizations and millions of individuals were concerned with its success. But people at that time did not have any official standing. However, many important groups worked hard, contacting delegates and passing resolutions. As late as 1932, at the opening of the disarmament conference in Geneva, an official meeting was set aside for representatives of organizations to present their views and resolutions. One of those persons is here in this studio, Mr. Jean Dupuy of the Department of Public Information at United Nations. Mr. Dupuy, tell us briefly what happened.
I keep a vivid memory of the solemn meeting of this conference on disarmament. Before 50 prime ministers or minister of foreign affairs, the representatives of a few large groups of international organizations expressed their feelings about the calling of this conference and people's wishes for its success. There were, for instance, the delegate of all religious organizations, the delegate for labor unions, the delegate for women's organizations. We presented an appeal signed by several millions of women of all countries. I had the honor of speaking in the name of 2 million students. One can really say that for the first time in international relations, public opinion made itself heard in an official assembly at one time in history.
And today, Mr. Dupuy, you are chief of the non-governmental organization section of the UN, which brings us to the San Francisco Charter. That charter not only included the words, "We the peoples," but an entire article, Article 71, and that article reads,
"The Economic and Social Council may make suitable arrangements for consultation with non-governmental organizations which are concerned with matters within its competence. Such arrangements may be made with international organizations and, where appropriate, with national organizations after consultation with a member of the United Nations concerned."
You may wonder why I'm giving you this background. It's because I'm anxious that each of you listeners realizes that you are probably represented right here at the United Nations. Almost all of us belong to some organization which is accredited with consultant status or as an observer. As an expert here, we have Mr. Charles Hogan, chief of the non-governmental organization Economic and Social Council. Mr. Hogan, will you tell us just what this consultative status means?
It means that practically all of the significant international private organizations in the economic and social field, that is, the trade unions, the women's organizations, the churches, Catholic, Protestant, Quaker, Jewish, the doctors, the lawyers, and the nurses, can speak to the council and to its subordinate bodies, can bring us information and experience. That means that all of those bodies will have wiser and fuller information on which to base their decisions and the recommendations which they make. It means also that in the field, the national and local constituents and members can assist in the carrying out of the programs and can get their governments to help in such matters as passing better legislation, in taking care of refugees, in taking care of children. It means that they can bring us information here and that they can also bring it back to the parts of the world that need it most.
To assist in spreading information about the UN, some 200 accredited observers representing you and me attend meetings and briefings, receive documents, talk with delegates, and work together to do an effective informational job. Hundreds of club members and local groups come to UN each year for special briefings. Well, enough of this, because we have representatives right here to tell us of the way peoples are working with and through governments to speed up the UN program in the fields of health, education, trade, women's and children's welfare, and so forth. First, I'd like to ask Dr. Elvin Reese of the Commission of the Churches on International Affairs to tell us how the UN has affected the backwash of World War II and the plight of the refugees, and what role the churches have played. Dr. Reese?
Well, if I started with the United Nations, I would have to refer first of all to the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, which is almost forgotten now, repatriated to their homes almost 9 million of the displaced persons after the war. Then the International Refugee Organization of the United Nations, which in its turn resettled more than 1 million people overseas. And following it, and still active at the present time, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, who is providing legal protection and helping in many other ways that he can. You mustn't forget either that these agencies have done their work in Europe. In the Near East, there's the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees, and in the Far East, there's the United Nations Agency for Korean Rehabilitation. But that's a very long story, which cannot be told in a moment or two. You asked me what role the churches have played, and I would much rather have been asked what role the religious groups have played, because the Roman Catholics, the Jews, and the Protestants have all worked together in a very remarkable degree to look after the people of their own faith. It is almost impossible to distinguish between the one or the other. There is a standing conference of voluntary agencies working for refugees in which these three religious groups play the major role, and they have played the major role in helping the IRO to do its task and a very special role in helping the United Nations High Commissioner. He, by his statute, is not operational, and any jobs that he wants done in procuring visas or helping people has to be done by these religious organizations. And I think, therefore, that the most remarkable role that is being played by people who are deeply concerned for men and women and children of their own faith and are trying to put that faith into practice to show them that they really care for their brethren. Would you like to listen to a minute to the story of one of these, or some of these refugees?
Yes, indeed. I think we all would, Dr. Reese. Let's turn the UN microphone over to Stanley Wright of the UN High Commissioner's Office for Refugees, who has a good illustration of what you've been telling us. Mr. Wright, what is your story?
I remember particularly well meeting the Mensing brothers. They had the opportunity of sailing for Canada, but they had with them their parents and their parents-in-law. Their mother was in weak health, and of course, all of the parents were older people, above the age of 45, which is the age limit for emigration. The two brothers couldn't face leaving these parents behind, If only, said one of the brothers to me, if only we could live somewhere here on a land we could call our own, we wouldn't mind starting from scratch. But how can we refugees ever hope to find a plot of land? Since then, spring 1952, things have changed. To witness this row of houses of my left, for in two of these houses live the Mensing brothers, and in little dependencies or annexes to the two houses live the parents and the parents-in-law. Yes, here the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees made come true a wish. From international funds placed at his disposal, he made loans available to these refugee farmers who were willing to build their own houses. These men had no guarantees or securities to set against these loans, except their determination and that of their families to surmount all difficulties and succeed. They could not, in the eyes of the High Commissioner, have had a better guarantee. These men, their womenfolk, and their children too, proved it. They dug the foundations, they placed stone upon stone, prepared their own mortar and cement, cut the wood, then hammered together doors, windows, and roofs. In their spare time, every evening, every lunchtime, every weekend, they built. It took the Mensings over 1 year before they could move in. But there are the houses now, living homes. In the field, I can see the Mensing brothers and their wives working on the land. They no longer look like refugees waiting for something to happen. They look like men and women, proud to belong to the land, happy in the satisfaction of their labor, people who have found peace and freedom and dignity. People who have found a home.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Now I would like to ask Dr. Richard Fegley of the World Council of Churches to tell us of their work in support of UN's Technical Assistance Program. We hear a great deal about it these days, and it's heartening to know that it has the help of such international and national groups as yours. Dr. Fegley?
For at least 150 years, Christian agencies, usually with modest budgets, have engaged in what is now called technical assistance, particularly in the fields of education and medicine. Therefore, Christian leaders have followed with keen interest and concern the UN's expanded technical assistance program, an international effort to share skills and technical knowledge with peoples in less developed countries. At the field level, Christian schools and hospitals have cooperated in many appropriate ways with the missions from the technical assistance agencies. Here at the headquarters level, we try to observe what is going on in the policy debates and decisions and report to the leaders of the churches. Also, we try to inform delegates of positions taken by our ecumenical agencies. Churchmen feel that the expanded program has made a good beginning in this field. It's a sign of the world's concern for social justice, and it's also a basically sound method to enable nations to work together for constructive ends. But it is, after all, only a beginning.
Dr. Fegley, what are your current objectives for technical assistance?
There are five. The program needs, we believe, one, a fuller picture of needs in the less developed countries. Secondly, better consultation between the UN and other international programs in this field. Three, a greater concentration of effort on more crucial projects, particularly in the densely populated countries. Four, a longer range of evaluation of the program against the unmet needs. And five, preparation now of plans for more adequate technical and financial assistance as possible improvement of the international situation makes new resources available. Would you like to listen for a minute to a typical story of technical assistance?
By all means, Dr. Fegley. For our example of UN technical assistance at work, here is Mr. Thomas F. Power, resident UN technical assistance representative in a country 5,000 miles away from us, Libya.
Training programs are a big part of the overall effort in Libya, which now we have about 75 experts, teachers, and technicians. And for 1955, the government is asking for 98 persons. We already have 26 nationalities there, and doubtless we'll have more in the increased teams. Health is actually one of the smaller programs, but both the Children's Fund and WHO are there. And just a few days ago, there was opened up, just outside Tripoli, a maternal and child health center. There, an Iraqi woman doctor and a Lebanese nurse are conducting a program designed to teach mothers how to take better care of their children, both before birth and when they're infants, and they will be training Libyan girls to serve as midwives. All of the agencies are participating or have been participating in Libya. I might cite as an example the FAO. Libya is basically an agricultural country, of course. And we've just recently had something that we call Operation Citrus, which was designed to sell oranges, also grapefruit and lemons, but primarily oranges, to overseas markets. It had a great success. The volume of Libyan oranges sold was increased by 70%, and the value was increased more than 100%. Basically, we're there to help the Libyan people to help themselves. Basically, we're there to show them new skills so that they can do the job for themselves, which is the ultimate aim of technical assistance, in order to make ourselves unnecessary, because the country has its own skills and a degree of prosperity which does not require foreign assistance.
They say children and women suffer most in all wars, and indeed constantly in many underdeveloped countries of the world. This was particularly true of children in war-torn areas. One of the sagas of the UN is its Children's Fund. Many of you, I'm sure, have seen Danny Kaye's famous film, Adventure UN. However, few of you probably know that Danny made a trip to the Far East as ambassador-at-large for UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund. The day he came back to headquarters, we of the radio and press interviewed him. I remember I asked Danny how he got along with children in faraway places. This was Danny Kaye's answer.
I think kids are the same the world over. You know, you begin to forget whether kids' eyes are slanty or whether they're round or whether they have brown hair or blue hair or green eyes or whatever it is. The problems of kids and the behavior of kids is exactly the same the world over. Now, these kids didn't know me from a hole in the ground, and I'm quite certain that most of them had never even seen a movie. And the natural suspicion of children, the natural kind of withdrawal before they realize you're not going to hurt them, is evident in every kid in the world. And all you need is to make a fool of yourself and behave like a kid yourself to gain the confidence of children. And then the same sense of humor applies to kids all over the world. And they run the same kind of fever.
Then I asked Danny where he went and why.
We went to a little place outside of New Delhi where they were doing a BCG program. The village elders all met in a square, and they were talked to by a man from UNICEF, trained by UNICEF. And he explained to them that if these people came into the village and were allowed to vaccinate their children, they wouldn't be quite as sick as they have been. Now, I don't think they have any idea of what UNICEF is, really, or where the money comes from, or what happens. They are in the kind of a state where all they want to do is get help for a child who is sick with great big burning eyes, and they will go almost any place. But with the pamphlets that are being distributed, with the knowledge that somebody is helping, the people who have any intelligence at all, and most of them are highly intelligent, ask where it's coming from, who is doing it, how it all comes about. And when these people explain, they have a much better idea of what the whole program involves after their kids have been treated. But before that, all a mother wants to know is, how can I relieve the fever of this child? And she'll go any place or talk to anybody to get her child well.
Before he left the UN, Danny Kaye had this final word for us correspondents.
In one country, there's a man called Mr. Keeney. Somebody said to him, what are you, you know, knocking your brains out trying to get all the kids of the world well and see that they grow up to maturity and all that? Because we're having a problem feeding the world. And doesn't it stand to reason that if these kids are allowed to grow up to maturity and be healthy, that the problem of food and all will become more acute than it really is? And isn't that nature's way of taking care of this problem? And Mr. Keeney looked at this man. He said, yes, that's a very nice idea. He said, I'd like you to think of it the next time your kid gets sick.
A representative of an organization that has done outstanding work in cooperation with UNICEF on a world level is here in our studio, too. Mr. Donald Wilson of the International Society for the Welfare of Cripples. Tell us, Mr. Wilson, of the practical ways in which your organization has promoted UNICEF.
I'm very happy indeed, Miss Frederick, to have this opportunity to tell you something about the program of the International Society for the Welfare of Cripples, particularly in relationship to the program of the Children's Fund of the United Nations. The International Society for the Welfare of Cripples is one of many voluntary organizations throughout the world who are vitally interested in the program of UNICEF and the work which is being carried on by that organization. The affiliated organizations of the International Society for the Welfare of Cripples have, during the past 30 years, started many pilot projects, particularly devoted to services for crippled children. One of the most important things that international organizations such as my own society does to support the UNICEF program is to become aware of the needs of the children of the world and bring these needs to the attention of not only the international organizations but also of national governments. It is this voluntary effort to understand the needs of the children of the world and to undertake pilot projects to demonstrate what can be done to improve the health and welfare of the children in the local communities. The children of the world are certainly our most priceless possession.
Well, that sounds as though there's some hope for healthy citizens of the future, the people through whom peace becomes possible. But there's another phase of this whole international question that we must face today, dollars and cents. One of the business groups engaged in work with the UN is the International Chamber of Commerce. And I'm happy to say we have around this table Mr. John Moore, Vice President of W.R. Grace & Company, who, as a member of the International Chamber of Commerce, attended the conference of ECOSOC in Santiago, Chile a few years ago. Mr. Moore, what happened then?
Miss Frederick, I am happy indeed to report on behalf of the International Chamber of Commerce as a non-governmental organization participating in the work of the Economic and Social Council. Our experience has been most satisfactory. The International Chamber of Commerce is committed to the proposition that healthy trade, properly conducted among friendly nations, brings higher living standards and works for peace and prosperity. In support of this objective, and as an example of the use of consultative status, we proposed to the Economic and Social Council the adoption of an international treaty to permit the free movement of business samples and advertising material in world commerce. We presented this proposition to the 12th session of the Council held at Santiago, Chile, in 1951. Now, 16 nations have signed. In our work, we have been particularly grateful for the assistance and warm welcome our representatives have received from the Secretariat. We are businessmen, not diplomats, and their expert help has been most appreciated. As an American businessman, I am particularly pleased that as a result of the work I have described, the peoples of many countries will soon have a fuller opportunity to appreciate the quality and integrity of the products of American industry made, sold, and transported by free men in our system of free enterprise.
And the business groups like yours, Mr. Moore, and Rotary, Kiwanis, and Lions are all doing a fine job in supporting UN. But as a woman moderator, I think it's about time I pointed out what the UN is doing for women, or I shall be hearing from them. Mrs. Esther Heimer, accredited observer for the International Business and Professional Women, is a hard-working NGO, as they're called, and she can tell us how her group of nearly 500,000 women in federations around the world are promoting the work of the Status of Women section of the UN. Mrs. Heimer, what is the status of the Status of Women?
Well, the Status of Women around the world, Miss Frederick, is improving as a result of the work of the United Nations this past 10 years. You know, more has been accomplished to eliminate discriminations against women than I think women themselves realize. At least that is what Minerva Bernardino, the chairman of the commission, has said. You know, this is done in a rather interesting way. It isn't just the United Nations doing something, but it is through the cooperation of the United Nations, through member governments, and through people in their organizations within the countries. Now let's see just how this really works. You know, the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women picks out questions that are particularly important in raising the position of women, some particular question of concern where there is discriminations, and they start out by opening up the subject, and they send out questionnaires to governments and to organizations, and they collect a perfectly terrific amount of factual information. They put it out in documents. People study it. And then when the commission meets, they examine this material and discuss it and come out with resolutions. Now, that resolution doesn't come out of thin air. It really relates to a condition that is permanent or seems to be permanent in many areas of the world. And their resolution set the international standard, a goal, so to speak, that they then can refer to other governments or to the Economic and Social Council. Sometimes it even goes to the General Assembly and then to governments. And in that way, they pinpoint a particular action that should be done in order to correct or eliminate discrimination against women. Well, then you see the international non-governmental organizations, or the NGOs as they call them, they take these resolutions and pick out one that is directly related to them. Now, for instance, the International Federation of Business Professional Women, of course, is concerned about the economic position of women. They're concerned about vocational guidance, about the pay women receive, and so they naturally pick out those resolutions that deal with them, just like the farmers or the Chamber of Commerce pick out those questions related to their area of interest. And then they prepare these documents that we've been talking about, that Mr. Fagley pointed out, that was done by the church people in connection with technical assistance. Only we take those documents that relate to particular problems that affect the businesswoman. And they send these out, memorandums, documents, pamphlets, letters, highlighting action that can be taken by groups within countries.
And now perhaps you will agree with me that if all the 200 non-governmental organizations at the UN are as effective as those represented in this studio, the UN will live and grow. You know, there's another word in the charter that intrigues me. It's determined. It follows that other important phrase, we the peoples. So the charter reads, we, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. On this day of reaffirmation of the UN, October 24th, it is certainly appropriate to hear the voices of the people and to sense their determination to make this greatest effort of mankind the success its drafters and architects meant it to be. You and I are part and parcel of this gigantic effort to bring peace to future generations and to improve their lives and preserve their liberties and happiness.
This has been a special transcribed roundtable discussion from United Nations headquarters. You have heard representatives from the International Chamber of Commerce, the World Council of Churches, International Business and Professional Women, International Society for the Welfare of Cripples, Commission of the Churches on International Affairs, and the United Nations Secretariat. Pauline Frederick, noted NBC commentator, was moderator. This program, in observance of the 10th anniversary of the United Nations, was produced by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with United Nations Radio.